and welcome to today's edition of World News Brief on the CGMRadio.com network. I am your host, Winston R. Holland. Thrilled to be with you today because on this special edition of World News Brief, we have a very special guest. His name, I won't leave you in suspense too long, is Rob Harmon. Now, why did I ask Rob to come on? Rob is the clinical assistant professor of pharmacology and pathophysiology. I have no idea what that last word means. At Sam Houston State University, he graciously agreed to come on. Rob, welcome to World News Brief.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I'm sure you say every guest is special.
Well, yeah, but I always say when they're with me, they're extra super special. But then if I say that to every guest, is that real legit? You know, maybe I'm kind of fake in that regard. However, I don't know. I don't like to be a fake. I like to be real. So you are extra super special, even if other guest is as well. But it's great to have you. And so Rob and I met two New Year's Eves ago.
Yes.
At Mark Cole's New Year's Eve party, who we had on the podcast just a few weeks ago, talking about how to save civilization. Kind of a big topic, a little weighty, but he had just some great stuff to talk about. Rob and I happened to sit next to each other and got further acquainted. I got to learn more about Rob, and he has quite a story, but I wanted just to let you know where the show is going today. I wanted him to come on because we're going to be, we began to talk about the masks. We began to talk about the vaccines. And the science behind all of that. I'm like, you know what? Not only does he know about that, he knows a lot about a whole bunch of other stuff. We're going to introduce you to him, his career, what he's doing now. It's quite fascinating. You won't want to miss it. But we're going to be talking about just the science and the efficacy. Do we need the masks? Do we need to get the vaccine? Not only that, but is it actually a good idea? Or could there be some harmful effects from both of those? So this is not a Facebook approved podcast, most likely. there very well could be a COVID disclaimer that shows up if we're not completely kicked off the platform. But Rob, if you would just give us a little bit about your background, your career, and you know what you've done in the past and what you're doing now.
Well, thanks again for having me on the show. My past, like many high schoolers that were misguided in the 80s, started with military service, and I started in Pershing nuclear missiles in Germany in the 80s. And I actually guarded them during the Cold War. It was quite of an experience. And that's a whole other show, actually, what happened during that time.
Okay, yeah, let's do it. We'll do it on a future show. I've never heard of the word Pershing.
Pershing nuclear missiles were mobile missiles, the same type of missile platforms that they were trying to put in Cuba, although we had them in Germany. And the nice thing about them was they were mobile, but the Pershing 2 missile could be fired so quickly that the Soviets couldn't defend against it. So one of the strategies that was put forth, that Reagan put forth, was let's deploy this in force and we'll break the back of the Soviet Union, both economically but with our weaponry. And it did, in a sense. It's credited with some of that, with bringing down the wall and the Cold War ending. And it was amazing time to be there. Actually, the unit received a presidential citation when we stood up the Pershing 2 missile.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's a pretty fascinating. That's just the beginning, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, it goes on.
That's just the beginning. So how long were you in the Army, and what rank did you end up achieving before retiring?
Well, I started in the 80s, like I said, and my career went from there to the 101st, and I was enlisted. Then I went to college, did my undergraduate at Austin Peay State, as a nurse and a biology professor. And after that, I went back and took a commission in the Army as a lieutenant. I went and graduated the Army's anesthesia program. It was a nursing anesthesia program. It's 3 years of hell.
I can only imagine.
Yeah, it's Army training. And then I did some further schooling after that. My doctoral work was, at that time, I was doing some advanced practice work and dissertation. And I was going to finish a dissertation in neuroscience, but I ended up, which we'll talk about, getting paralyzed. So So I finished a dissertation.
Yes,
and,
yes. For some context, we're sitting in Rob's living room right now. Yeah. So the podcast is not in the studio right now. So if it doesn't have the kind of quieter sound, yeah, sound absorption, that's why. But I'm sitting in a regular chair, but Rob is sitting in a wheelchair. So yeah. I guess we'll get to that story soon. But also some very interesting news in that regard. Well, some very good news. And we need as much good news as we can get these days, right? So I'm sorry, continue.
Also the good news is I'm going to be getting a hydraulic C-brace from Autobox, so I'll be walking again. So that is a major blessing. But
and how long have you been in the wheelchair for?
4 years. 4 years.
Four
now.
Years. Yeah. 4 years. And it started during your military career. What do you think kicked off? Like, why? How did you end up in the wheelchair?
We believe it was a exposure to some neurotoxins after anesthesia school and some dissertation work and resilience, some other academic work I was doing and traveling around to different universities and different hospitals studying. I in between all that fun, I also had to deploy, and I deployed as a trauma anesthesia provider. My first deployment during the Afghan war after 2000 and 2001 was to the invasion of Afghanistan, and that was to a place called K2. In fact, if you ever watch the movie 12 Strong, and where they're getting off in K2 to go down and invade Afghanistan, that's actually exactly the time I was invading.
Wow.
My orders, in fact, they're in the wall in my office, my orders back to the military at the rank of major, where I would take on the job of setting up the EMT element for the invasion of Afghanistan in the northern part. My orders back to the military were September 11th, 2001. So when I was holding my orders, I was watching the towers fall. So I went back after I was enlisted in the 101st Wow. Airborne. I went back to the medical unit there, and within a couple months, I was deployed. And if you watch the movie, when they got off the plane, they one of the guys in the movie says, "Who are these guys?" And they say, "They're our friends." And I said, "They don't look like friends to me." And I said the same thing when I got off the plane in K2, because it was a hostile environment and it was a toxic waste dump. Actually, K2 was a former Soviet base where they kept nuclear biological weaponry.
And
the last executive order that Trump initiated was to investigate the exposure that the military let its soldiers, be exposed to in that area. So it's an executive order tracking all the people that are deployed there. And there's actually a Facebook page. A lot of people have been dying, neurological diseases, a lot of cancers, people that were exposed there. So, that was my first deployment after the towers fell. Then I was fortunate not to have a lot of deployments. I had some deployments to Central America, some other places. But my last deployment was in 2010. Where I was in Afghanistan, I was with the British. And that's kind of segue into the mask thing that we're going to talk about, and how the British were using masks. And they had a full hospital there. They built a full hospital, and they had a freedom flight every day taking casualties back to Great Britain. And I did trauma anesthesia with them. And that was during the height of the casualties during the war. It was one of those things, like if you ever remember watching MASH as a child, every time you laid down, you heard the choppers coming in, or you were going out on a chopper getting casualties. It was pretty bad. The British didn't have up armored vehicles like we had, so they stayed on foot patrol more, and they were reaping. It was horrible. They were reaping the benefit of, or not the benefit of, the horrors of not being in up armored vehicles.
They should have sent some armored vehicles. Why didn't they have armored vehicles?
It was just their. You know, Rumsfeld said something that was true and horrible. You go to war with the army that you have, and the vehicles they have weren't up armored vehicles. In fact, it got so bad that I actually bumped into Cameron, the Prime Minister. He was coming around the corner because he wanted to see why the casualty rates were so high. And I literally came around the corner. I just had a guy in the OR, and I literally bumped into him. And he pushed back. He goes, "Oh, I'm so sorry," And he was down there, seeing firsthand what was going on. It was horrible. I mean, they were losing, they had multiple casualties daily, and so he pulled him off the wire, and they were stood down. They weren't going to do any more missions. So the Dark Horse Marines took up the mantle. And the first day they went out, 26 of them were killed. So that was during the Obama administration. That's when I wasn't a fan of his administration, and they were telegraphing, all our movements, and you know, giving too much intel away from the White House about what was going on, and we were suffering the casualties because of it.
There are no words. Why would he do something like that? If a reporter were to ask him, why are you telegraphing the move of our troops? What excuse do you think Obama would give them?
I don't think that he has an excuse. I'm sure. I don't want to, you know, mock him or try to do a parody of his voice at this point. But
are you sure you don't?
Yeah. I'll let you do it
because
for me.
We always can. But okay, yes. Please go ahead. Say what you were going to say.
I think that he was just an inept leader. He's what's the word? Feckless leader.
Feckless, yeah.
He was a feckless leader, and he should have never been in that position. And I think it was a lot of ignorance on his part. He really believed that, you know, this was the way to draw down troops, that, you know, there could be a reasonable conversation with these despots, these, you know, these evil leaders in those positions. And it didn't work out well. And it never works out that well. It's the only thing they respect is strength, the show of strength. And Trump proved that because he went in and he told the generals, just handle it, get rid of it, you know, full force. And they understood that, and it didn't take very long, and it doesn't. Now let's get another point: was I a fan of the war? Was I a fan of Iraq? Absolutely not. And we could talk another show about all I know about, you know, the beginning of that. I didn't feel like it was the right move. I didn't feel like it was the right enemy. But you know, when you are a soldier, you go where you're told. You don't complain about the war. You just go and do your job, and it was an honor to
sure.
take care of these guys. These Marine, amazing, amazing Marine. I love Marines, just absolutely love them. I love taking care of them.
Wow, I can only imagine. So I did have one question for you in that regard, in regard to the war. So I was told many years ago and for the life of me, I can't remember which friend told me this, but their father was high up in the military with Iraq, and they basically told their kid that the reason why we had to go to war with Iraq was because Saddam Hussein was literally about to nuke and destroy Israel. And so I have no idea if that is true or not. I remember hearing it, and it was from the child of whose father was definitely in the know. So I'm just curious, did you ever hear anything about that in your time? It's something that's I've been wondering about for years.
No, I don't believe that would have happened, and I believe a greater enemy of Israel is who we know now to be Iran. And I think that was the real enemy. I think that the proximity of to the oil fields, the control of the oil, was the main reason that we went after Saddam. America had its foothold in there, and if we fix the problem for them, then, you know, it was...
It's disgusting. Yeah, and how many lives as a result of that?
I don't know. I know I zipped up way too many body bags. Yeah.
Firsthand. It's horrific. That is why America first doesn't mean America only or America screw the rest of the world.
Correct.
It means let's not be idiots. Let's not be evil. Let's not get into all of these foreign wars that we have no business getting into, and that we're ultimately gonna lose thousands of lives. We're gonna spend trillions of dollars. And what's the outcome at the end of it?
I mean, Trump proved that you could have strength and strengthen foreign policy and not go to war. And that's a lot of
Reagan proved that. Yeah, I mean, Reagan proved that bigly. Right, I mean, you look at what how the wall fell, without firing a shot, it's remarkable. All right, we could do a few shows about that one, and I love talking about Reagan too. So we can talk about Reagan together anytime. But we're here. So you're a professor of pharmacology and pathophysiology at Sam Houston State. We started talking about masks, started talking about the vaccine, and so I wanted to have you on the show to get your point of view. So the question is, do masks work?
The short answer is no, not for the purpose that we're using for. And I just want to qualify something. I am a professor of pharmacology and pathophysiology. I teach right now in the College of Nursing, I'm hoping to teach it at a graduate level, but right now I am teaching undergraduate, so I'm not... I'm not actively involved in research and pathophysiology, but I do have a strong background in it, and I was, you know, with the British post some studies that we did on masks.
Okay. So. Okay. Cool. Okay. So So what I have seen in terms of the size of the COVID virus versus the size of, let's say, the holes that are in the mask or the very small openings in the mask.
0.3 in the N95 mask, it'll filter up to 0.3. The COVID virus is around 0.125 microns.
Okay.
So 0.3 mics. So there's I can you know address that, and I can talk about Brownian movement and why they think they work, and why you can catch some of it, and the thinking behind droplets, and that.
Please go, go.
So
whatever else, whatever what you think is most relevant, most important for the
First of all, let me do what I do with my students, and that's, you know, question everything. You know, treat me like I'm lying to you, and that's probably the best thing, to be a, you know, be a Berean. Sure. With the scripture, you know, figure it out for yourself.
Sure.
And take everything with a grain of salt.
And I'm going to put links to any resources and studies that you talk about. The links will be in the show notes of this podcast, so you can find it at cgmradio.com, or if you're looking at it on your podcasting app, you can get it there. And I'll have it all linked also up at our news aggregator site, cgm.news, so that way that you guys can have access to all of this as well. So you can look at it for yourself.
But a little background to you that are science novice or healthcare novice, you know, that have a great trust and respect for you know, physicians and researchers, which we should. We should respect their work and what they do. But, you know, when I was growing up, everybody told me that the world was going to freeze over because of CO2 gases, and we're going to have an ice age, and you know, that never happened. And when I was doing trauma, my first trauma studies in my undergraduate work, and then in some of my graduate work at Vanderbilt University, we were studying trauma resuscitation, and we were doing something called full volume resuscitation. And these were the smartest physicians on the planet. They were setting what was called advanced cardiac life-saving protocols, advanced trauma life-saving protocols. And they had developed all these catheters to place into the heart. It was the most amazing work they were doing. And everybody was dying. And they were doing everything wrong. In fact, if we did everything the way they did now, you would be, you know, sued for malpractice. You would be shut down. Because we were doing everything wrong, because we weren't following the science of really what the body, how the body reacts to trauma. So when I say, you know, don't trust anything anybody has to say until you prove them right. The problem with trusting the experts is oftentimes the experts are wrong. And we have to remember that, and we have to, when we look at these studies, when we look at what our experts are telling us to do, you know, we really have to ask, does it make sense? Does it meet the science benchmark? And a lot of the arguments about the mask are at the level of, you know, it's the virus is too small, you know, the mask won't work. And when I was with the British, I was shocked. I went into the British OR the first trauma day I had there, and nobody was wearing masks except for the surgeons. They were right over the surgical field. So I asked, I said, you know, why aren't you guys wearing masks? And the anesthesia trauma guy's got a cup of coffee by the anesthesia machine. He goes, they don't work. We've proved that in some studies. In fact, I'm looking at a study right now from 2003 that the British actually did on masks. So you have to ask them, what were masks designed for? Well, masks were designed to protect the patient from infection. And the thought was, you know, you could cough or the water droplets or anything could get into the wound. And therefore, let's wear a mask to keep those water droplets out. Well, when you're right over the surgical wound, that makes sense. But the studies showed that the mask, the surgical mask that they were wearing, were not stopping infection, that they could not make a correlation between improved infection rates with or without a mask. So they stopped wearing masks in their OR. So why would people think the mask work? A lot of people were surmising that, well, you know, if everybody was wearing them, then it would trap particles because of the Brownian movement of molecules connecting to water vapor and the viruses and then getting caught up in the mask. The problem with that thinking is, how does it go through the mask? What they found in a recent N95 study, which was pretty recent, was even an N95 filter mask couldn't be fitted properly, and that they would leak around the outside of the mask. So where are you trapping the particles? Well, unless you live in Houston with the humidity here, or San Antonio, you know, the humidity is coming from when you breathe out. Therefore, if anything's going to get caught by humidity, it's going to get caught on the inside of the mask. So if you're breathing around the outside of the mask, which the mask that most people are wearing today, that's what you're breathing. And then and then by any chance that the virus is catching humidity and then getting into the mask, then it's more on the inside of the mask. And the other issue is people are wearing these cloth masks. I mean, these are absolutely worthless. It's paramount to me saying, you know, it's dusty outside, so put some chicken wire on your face. I mean, they don't capture anything. Now, the thinking is that if everybody's trapping, you know, the virus maybe on the inside of the mask, that if everybody wears masks, the risk is down. Well, the problem with this argument is what stops infection? And during the 90s, we were having a real problem with infections in hospitals, and MRSA came about, the streptococcus that was resistant to even our strongest antibiotics. And so what we did was we found, after culturing everything, that it was on all the surfaces, so that washing our hands was the key. And then we discovered that washing our hands was the key to stopping most infection. So if washing your hands is the key, why isn't that the first thing we're talking about? And I say that because people take the mask off. They touch the mask. They're readjusting the mask all day long. You know, they take it off several times a day. So when you take it off, you have whatever you've trapped the mask is on your fingers. We've started to do some research, not me in particular, but I've been tracking some research, and it is not completed yet. But what we're seeing is that people that wear masks don't wash their hands as much. It's like a false sense of security. It's the same. Wearing a cloth mask to me is the same as telling adults that there's a boogeyman and you need to get under the covers. And you're just like a child, you know, getting under the sheets at night. So, you know, do they work? If they do at all, it is very limited, and they're probably causing more harm than good because people aren't washing their hands.
Wow. So, well, that leads me to a couple studies. So there is and I wanted to get your thoughts on, well, there's a more recent study. I'll get to that one in a second. But there was a major large-scale Danish study that this was published November 18th. That finds no evidence that wearing a face mask significantly minimizes people's risk of contracting COVID-19. And this was a pretty large study that was employed after coronavirus began. And from what you were telling me before, I mean, this thing was pretty well suppressed. They didn't really want this to get out there.
Nope. They really suppressed the study. They did not want this study published because it corroborates everything we knew about masks before the outbreak. And it's just like government does. They feel like you've got to do something. And healthcare providers are guilty of this. We always feel like we have to do something. Like you can't just do nothing. So what do you do? Well, I mean, a good thing to do would be to wash your hands and maybe look at more of the prophylaxis, the things that stop. And this is what really, really gets me. And I think that there's a lot of people guilty of this, and I don't want to name names, but putting all your stock in development of a virus, not looking at the prophylaxis, which we know has some impact, and you know, promoting masks is the way to stop this, and not talking more about everybody wash your hands continually. I really think that we've caused a lot of deaths. I believe there's most of these deaths that we're seeing, the tragic outcomes with COVID, are because the approach was completely wrong. I have friends on the front line, nurses, nurse practitioners, doctors that have been intubating these patients, putting tubes down these patients' throats. They've been on the front line and they've not contracted it. And the one thing they have in common is they're using the prophylaxis, you know, and so that tells me that there's some stock in it. Now, what's the problem with the prophylaxis? It's cheap. I mean, there's nobody making any money off of a hydrochloroquine or some of the other things that you can use, some of the other quinacin and some other things you can use that would drive zinc when you're taking zinc into the cell, which it's, you know, the zinc nasal sprays, the oral sprays, all the things that we could be using and could be promoting, because we know that the virus is very susceptible to zinc.
And that's what I want to. So I remember, we all do. We're all watching those daily coronavirus briefings with Trump and Fauci and all of them back in the day. And I remember I had no problem with Fauci. I had zero problem with Fauci. I'm watching him every day. He seemed like he was trying to do the right thing and so forth. And he was asked a question about hydroxychloroquine, and he said immediately, well, there are no studies, it's only anecdotal evidence, and that was pretty much it. And at that point, I knew, okay, I know I can't trust you, because I've seen studies with my own eyes.
Yeah.
What in the world is this guy talking about? And he's the head of the NIH or whatever, and that's too bad. I didn't want to not trust him. I didn't have anything against him, but at that point, I just felt it. I was like, oh my gosh, this is a problem. What's going on there?
Money drives the train. You know, I went to undergraduate at Austin Peay State University. Anybody that's an Austin Peay graduate out there, you know, we say let's go Peay. You know, that's it's a really funny thing to say. And you know, if you graduated there in Tennessee, it's a great school. And I was privileged to go there because my professors were from World War II. My history professor marched in the Bataan Death March. My biology professor was a creationist, and he, you know, found God in a foxhole in the Battle of the Bulge.
A creationist at a state-funded university.
Back in the day when, you know, Darwinism was it. And you know, I had great professors, and they all agreed, and especially my history professors, they always told me, you know, just follow the money. The money always drives you to the truth. And that's true today. I mean, wars, what we're seeing right now with the virus, with the what's going on with the government that's, you know, buying in large stock, the vaccine, you know, money drives the train. And unfortunately, that's the truth. And in the beginning, Fauci was not a big fan of masks. And if you look back at, you know, his history, you know, before he had that position, he might have varied in what he was telling people about. Maybe we should look more into the hydroxychloroquine. The amazing thing about it is it's not dangerous. We give it to every soldier. Everybody in the military that's been deployed gets it. So on a large scale, we're giving it. If you have rheumatoid arthritis, you get it, and you're high risk because you're older. People are not dropping dead because of hydroxychloroquine. It is an incredibly safe medication to give, and yet all of a sudden, the studies come out that it's not. I experienced this firsthand. There's a drug we use to put people to sleep. It's a paralytic, and it sucks acetylcholine. We used it for years. And it was safe. It was safe in children, safe in everybody. We didn't have any issues. There was outlying patients that might have a problem with it, but it was rare. When the drug companies wanted to produce a better drug or different drug, not a better drug, but a different drug to take its place, they came out with something called Mivacron. Mivacron was terrible. It didn't work. We only used it for a couple years till we told the drug companies, it's absolutely a terrible drug. It's got too many side effects. It doesn't work like you said it was going to work. And we're giving up on it. But it's interesting when the same drug company that owns the succinylcholine, who they lost their trademark for it, and it was now you could get it generic, and it was cents on the dollar. But they all of a sudden there was a study about how succinylcholine was dangerous in pediatric patients. This drug we've been using forever, but there was no money in it. But suddenly it was dangerous, so they black boxed the drug and we couldn't give it to pediatric patients.
Well, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, and now all of a sudden we're forced to use a drug that has horrible histamine release reactions, and we're putting these patients to sleep, and they're getting, looks like they're having anaphylaxis in front of us. So, you know, I've had experience first line with, you know, seeing the way drug companies, you know, do their business. Now, are they all evil? No, they do some amazing work. I have friends that have worked in the research in the drug company industry, and you know, they'll be first to defend it, saying, you know, they do amazing work, and they do. But a lot of problems I have is with the whole, you know, pharmaceutical industry is, you know, they're not about cure, they're about taking care of the symptoms, they're about making money. I mean, just recently they lowered the standard for high blood pressure, meaning what was acceptable for blood pressure suddenly was much lower. And I told my students, I said, who benefits from this? Is this really a study that shows the patients are benefiting from treatment for hypertension? It, you know, now we're, instead of treating it at 140 over 90 a blood pressure, we're going to now treat, you know, 130 over 80. I mean, think about the population that has blood pressures within that range, and now they're getting medication.
Millions of more people need the drug.
Millions more people suddenly need the drug. So these are the kind of things that you after 30 years of being in the healthcare, you know, you start to notice.
It's the kind of stuff you notice but you're not allowed to talk about it. No. Or you're a conspiracy theorist. You're a crazy conspiracy theorist. Yeah. Well, the reality is there are conspiracies. And there are conspiracies right now. And by the way, I mean, certain group of people like to call people on the right conspiracy theorists. But, I mean, you look at Russiagate. There's all kinds of conspiracy theories on the left. So I wanted to ask you about this other thing before we jump into the vaccine. I wanted to ask you about a recent study came out, and it is that the CDC basically claims mask mandates don't have statistically improved impact on spread of COVID than no masks at all. Will therefore continue pushing masks. So this report came out from the CDC. Mask mandates lower COVID cases by around 1.5% over a two-month period. However, it's actually within the statistical margin of error. This is from March 7th. This just came out. So it's within the statistical margin of error that places that have masks versus places that don't have mask mandates. And there's no statistical difference, but they're saying still wear the masks.
You know, it's crazy because I was rolling around the university and I was trying to take bets. I got on Facebook. I said, I'll take $1,000 bets. From anyone, $1,000 that within 18 months of this whole thing, we're going to start seeing pushback that this doesn't work. And there it is. And it's less than 18 months and nobody took a $1,000 bet from me.
Too bad.
Yeah, I was out there on social media. I was like, please, somebody bet me $1,000 that this kind of stuff.
And this is from the CDC.
I know. I said from the CDC.
Breitbart. This is from Breitbart. This is from the CDC. But of course, continue to wear a mask. So now I'm going to put my tinfoil hat on a little bit. Okay, yeah. You ready? You know, I saw this article in the American Thinker, and it's something that we've all been thinking. I think when you get past. You discuss the science, you discuss the data, you get into the masks, you get into the intent, and you find, okay, what are those that are in charge really want? And I saw this article that says, it's from March 10th, it's up at cgm.news. Masks are just part of the socialist uniform. Do you think that there is something more to this than their belief that masks are for our safety?
Well, the two things I think, if I'm going to think conspiracy, which I've been in the belly of the dragon for 30 years, so I know what goes on in the military, and I know things that I can talk about, things I won't talk about. But one thing is facial recognition. I mean, it's been a great experiment in facial recognition software for people that wear the mask. The second thing is, you know, how can we control society? And fear is always the tool. You know, fear is the great controller of society. Sure. And so if you can scare everybody into wearing a mask, which now are going to show probably to be of more harm than good, then that's huge. And here's another thing that people don't think about is our identity is on our face. I mean, everything, when you look in the mirror, that's your identity. When people see you, that's your identity. There's so much about our identity that's more than the face, but our identity really is in our face. It's how we get recognized. It's who we see when we're talking, how we visualize ourselves. We visualize ourselves from our face. So if you can take people's identity away, that's taking away everything in a society, the individual. It's completely taking away the individual.
And isn't that what Marxism is? Isn't that what socialism is? That socialism is it's not a conspiracy theory. It's real political philosophy that essentially says that what does not matter is the individual. What matters is the collective and what the collective does and what the collective produces for the god of socialism, which is the state, and usually run by a communist party, a single party system. So it does appear like what you're saying to go right in line with what has become very popular in today's Democrat Party, which is socialism.
Yeah, it is. And taking away the individual identity. I mean, they see anybody that says, you know, individual exceptionalism is, you know, a great value of the United States, where, you know, individuals can, you know, make their own businesses. They can do phenomenal things, and there's no limit, you know, with creativity and a little drive, that what you can accomplish here that you can't accomplish anywhere else in the world. And that's why so many people are, you know, trying to get here, and I don't blame anyone for trying to get here. You know, I've seen communism firsthand at the, you know, yeah, the other side of the wall. I've seen, you know, I've been to Central America. I've been all over the world to see, you know, how horrific it is in other people, other nations, and it's incredible here. You know, while we're just getting out of the mask thing, there's one last thing I want. If anybody has doubt to what we say, really, it's very simple. Just get on your computer and Google pictures of virology labs. And when you Google those pictures, what you're going to see is people that work with the coronavirus, you know, wearing full respirators and all get up. So if that's the standard, you know, to really prevent a virus, then you're going to leave that lab and put on a little cloth mask. I mean, come on.
I know. It's ridiculous. I could literally, I've said this before on my show, I'll say it again. I could literally cut off the bottom half of my shirt and I could wrap it around my face and I'm compliant. Yeah. I'm wearing a quote mask and I can get in. I can go to the grocery store. I can go to Chipotle. I can go to Starbucks. I can go to wherever.
Actually, you'd be more accepted because your look.
Yeah.
That midriff.
Yeah,
you know?
I know. Well, you know what? I try not to dress too salaciously, but sometimes I just can't resist. That would be a terror to see. But yeah, so that's what's, it's bizarre. It's almost like it is. And we could spend a lot of time talking about that. And I want to get into the vaccine itself, but it's, and I've said this many times as well, we should be suspicious when everything that they need to do for our safety and our security goes right in line with their political agenda. Like what you were saying about small businesses. I mean, the amount of small businesses that have been decimated and jobs that are lost in the middle class that has been just decimated because of this and the rising income inequality. They say they care about income equality. Well, when people are out of work, when people don't have businesses, when people don't have small businesses, you destroy the middle class. You essentially, I mean, we're really, they call themselves progressives, but let's be honest, that's pretty regressive when you're going back to feudalism and a society of lords and serfs, which appears to be kind of the way that they want us to go. So I'll say on that, but it does appear it's a sign of submission. It's a sign of silence. It's a sign of obedience. It's a sign, are you in on the agenda? And it doesn't protect you from the very thing that they claim that it protects us from.
No, and you're right. They have decimated the middle class. The real people that have been hurt by this are the middle to lower class. And their lives, their livelihoods, their dreams, their businesses have been lost forever. I mean, they're not going to recover. And then they say they're, you know, passing a bill to help them out, and only 8% of the bill even barely focuses on COVID relief. And the rest goes to their political agenda and their political bailing out, you know, their failing cities under, you know, an agenda and a political agenda that does not work. And it's insanity. You know, it's insanity is doing something over and over again and it failing, and you just keep doing it and it never gets a different result. And when they said, you know, well, we actually see that one mask doesn't work, so let's just double down and do two masks. That's typical government response.
Yeah, it's, you know, it just kind of makes sense. Like, that's not science. Like, it just kind of makes sense.
Exactly.
That a second mask would help more.
Yeah, it's...
Huh?
Yeah, and this is really, this really drives me crazy because these are people that propose to be evidence-based practitioners, you know, because everything is about, you know, evidence-based.
Right,
of course. It's not, but it's not... Money always trumps evidence. Money always trumps science. But here's the thing. You know, when you want to accuse somebody or you want to get away with something, you always accuse the other person of doing what you're doing. I mean, it's very...
Is that not a Saul Alinsky tactic?
And so every time they start to accuse somebody or they single somebody out for cancel culture, I think, you know, you're the one that's guilty of it.
Oh my gosh. I mean, they literally digitally assassinated the president of the United States,
removing his voice
from social media. That's a harsh term, but that's essentially what they did. He had 80 million followers
on Twitter,
and they snuffed him out.
He did more for lower income and minorities than any other president. He kept us out of war. Our economy was improving. He's the one that said lock down China. And then he's handed, you know, he's a builder. He's not even a politician. And he's handed medical advisors that he has to follow. I mean, he couldn't really bow up against them.
Right.
And he tried. He tried to, you know, say, you know, we need methylchloroquine. But, you know, the president of the United States is not all powerful. And, you know, unfortunately for Trump, you know, they were really cutting him off at the knees, you know.
Yeah, it was, he had his own inner circle against him in many ways. And that, yeah, we'll see if that happens again. We'll see if they're not able to get rid of him, if they're not able to indict him and put him in jail somehow, which they're trying to do right now. I think he's learning his lesson. I'm very grateful he has someone like Jason Miller as a close advisor who's a strong, solid MAGA guy. I like what he's doing with the Save America PAC. And it could be that in the future, if he does run again and win, if that's even possible, depending on how things go with the fraud and the states really taking back their Article II powers, it'll be, you know, it'll be interesting to see if he learns his lesson and he doesn't surround himself with people like Rex Tillerson and H.R. McMaster's,
yeah,
and even John Bolton and even Mark Meadows,
yeah,
working against him during the election fraud stuff. It's Freedom Caucus. I can't put my mind around it. Okay, let's talk about this vaccine. So I guess my question for you, you know, I printed out an explanation of the vaccine from the Mayo Clinic. And
mayonnaise clinic.
That's, yeah, yeah, the mayonnaise, right. The Mayo Clinic, mayo and mustard clinic. And it says here, I'll just read this real quick. Both the Pfizer BioNTech and the Moderna COVID-19 vaccines use messenger RNA. Coronaviruses have a spike-like structure on their surface called an S protein. COVID-19 mRNA vaccines give cells instructions for how to make a harmless piece of an S protein. After vaccination, your cells begin making the protein pieces and displaying them on cell surfaces. Your immune system will recognize that the protein doesn't belong there and begin building an immune response and making antibodies, essentially doing the thing that a vaccine, I guess, normally does or is the purpose of it. But as I'm reading this, I'm wondering, is this technically a vaccine?
When you're dealing with a messenger RNA, technically, I want to say no, but I don't know enough about it, and that's the problem. When you're dealing with a messenger RNA, you know, we don't know enough about it. I mean, they're just now releasing information about it. It's kind of like this vaccine, quote vaccine, if it is purely a vaccine, is kind of like when the government passes a 10,000-page, you know, piece of legislation, and they give you an hour to read it, and they say, just trust us. You know, we don't know what's in it, but just trust us, and we'll pass it. We'll read it afterwards. And it was rushed out so fast. It gives me pause. It gives me concern. The reactions that are happening with it, the side effects I hear are concerning. The side effects are a lot like autoimmune disease side effects. And then that's bothersome to me. A true vaccine is a virus that is dead, or a bacteria that is dead, and or whatever that is dead that we introduce, and then it creates an antibody. The body recognizes the bacteria or the virus or whatever it is.
Right.
They recognize it, and your body builds antibodies against it. That's the way our immune system works. Okay, so that when we develop anything that we give that is preventive, that's what we give. We give dead virus, and then you build antibodies to it. When you're dealing with the messenger RNA, this is some new technology, and there's several ways that we, with antivirals and antibacterials, that we attack viruses and we attack these things. But we know how to attack a virus. We know the prophylaxis that works. We know we have antiviral medications. So, you know, why not an antiviral medication instead of, you know, messing with the messenger RNA on a short rollout where we really don't have long-term studies about its effects on humans?
Well, are we the experiment? Are we the long-term experiment?
In this, we are. Oh, yes, in this we are. In this case, there's never been a virus rolled there's never been a vaccine rolled out so fast. And this is the one thing that, you know, I do... really love what Donald Trump did with clearing out the swamp. But, you know, rushing out a vaccine like this, it is really bothersome. you know, really bothers me that we did this and now we are the experiment. And it's kind of almost cult-like taking it. It's kind of like the shift our society is taking. Like, if you don't take this, then you're really going to be shunned. I have somebody I know that was working in a vaccine clinic, and she said, I'm not taking. I told them that, and they're really treating her kind of standoffish. Like, you know, what's wrong with you? They're giving her a hard time. But you know, when people come in and get the vaccine, it's this little, you know, thank you so much for taking this. You're saving other people. You're not going to spread it now. And they go on and on with these accolades about, you know, you're part of us now, you know, and it's a little bit concerning, you know, that there's this kind of culture around a short rollout vaccine that we really don't know the long-term effects.
Yeah, and that's why I'm not going to take it.
I mean, I'm not either. You know, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, I had COVID and it wasn't the worst thing I've ever had. And I think that the herd mentality should have been, you know, what we focused on. Like I said, the prevention, the prophylaxis. And I don't think we have seen the deaths. I really believe that.
Well, and talk to me about herd immunity for a second. I've got more on the vaccine I want to mention. But it was very interesting because there was, I believe it was on, I forget, there was an official site where that talked about herd immunity. I don't know if it was, what's the big one, everyone? The coronavirus, the big coronavirus database. What's Johns Hopkins? On Johns Hopkins, it may have been Johns Hopkins or another one where they talked about herd immunity. That they updated what herd immunity means from, and don't quote me on the Johns Hopkins, I'd have to look it up, it may have been another site, to where it used to have the idea of herd immunity being when a society, you know, when most of society gets a virus, they develop a immunity to it. And they updated it to say that when everyone in a society gets a vaccine, then they are, herd immunity.
That's absurd because, I mean, herd immunity is a small percentage of them getting, of them being exposed, building antibodies. And we really don't have a full understanding of that, of, you know, how a society becomes immune with such a small fraction of the people actually with exposure, with testing positive. There's also the viral load. I mean, if you get a huge viral load all at once, your symptoms may be worse as opposed to being, you know, slightly exposed to it, where you can, you know, you can build immunity. I mean, it's a wicked virus. It has every bit design all over it. But, you know, that gets into the whole creation thing. I mean, we are designed. It's obvious we're designed. I could spend a whole show telling you how it's obvious we are designed. And when you really start to look at a virus, they look more mechanical in nature, you know, than they do what we'd like to term biological. And like you were talking, the S-shaped proteins, the crown, the way they hook into your nasal cavity, you know, it is bad. I'm not downplaying the COVID. It is a bad deal, but the way we dealt with it, you know, really, really is telling. I mean, it's really concerning for me. And there's a lot of people that are dead today that I think if we would have thought about the herd immunity, about getting people, you know, exposed and while doing the prophylaxis, you know, that.
Well, and especially those groups that are, you know, they're the groups that are less likely to, far less likely to die from it and so forth, not locking them in their homes, but letting them continue to function in daily life in order to build the herd.
Exactly.
Build the herd immunity. And of course, all of the consequences of the lockdowns and all that's a whole other show in and of itself.
And I want to qualify this. I'm not completely opposed to vaccines. I mean, the polio vaccine, some of the things that we've eradicated. I mean, we've done great work. But we just kind of got vaccine crazy and the rollout on these vaccines and what we're vaccinating for. And it really is bothersome. And
are you comfortable mentioning we discussed a particular vaccine that you had gotten and it was 2 weeks after that?
I should have gotten an MMR titer. I didn't think it'd be a problem because I was vaccinated so many times, but my immune system had taken a hit from, you know, one of my deployments and I was run down, I was exhausted, I was tired, and I took a booster of an MMR that I should not have taken. And with the neurological issues that were going on within that 2 weeks period, I was paralyzed. And I went to the vaccine board and the court. I went to the vaccine court and they wouldn't take my case because of my military exposures and they couldn't prove that it was purely a vaccine. And this is another thing people don't know, is as these makers of vaccine, I don't know what legislative act it is, but they cannot be sued.
Yeah.
So the government set up a vaccine court, and it's virtually impossible to collect from the court to prove that it was the vaccine. So it's just a big game.
And not only that, but with each, my understanding is with each vaccine that is produced, there's basically a vaccine court type tax or a vaccine injury
yes.
tax
yes.
that goes to then pay out to people who actually are able to successfully
exactly.
get a positive,
exactly.
positive ruling from the court.
Yeah, and it's rare. So, but there's, you know, my case, I tried to go, I had an attorney and it just fell short because of my exposure in the military, all the things I was exposed to. And they said, well, you know, we can't rule out that it wasn't that exposure as opposed to the vaccine. So therefore, you know, no.
Well, I mean, and that's what that documentary Vaxxed was about the MMR. And what's ironic about that documentary is that documentary, I've watched it. It is not anti-vaccine.
No.
The big claim of Vaxxed is we need to break up the MMR because the MMR altogether has been very dangerous. And we've seen result after result after all these people that have been seriously injured for life, if not died,
yeah.
right after taking it. And it's like, look, and people went ballistic. Went ballistic. It was not even anti-vaccine. It was just like you were talking about the culture of this stuff. It's like it is. It's like you can't question. You
no.
can't anything. Even no. Get measles. Get a mump shot. Get rubella shot. Just don't get them all at the
yeah.
same time.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like you know we're gonna melt like the ladies outside of the Supreme Court when Brett Kavanaugh, you know, during the Brett Kavanaugh hearings or something like that. I mean, it is really, really strange. And that's what I wanted to, you know, because there has been some really disturbing things that have come after some people have taken this vaccine. So this was in Utah. This is March 10th. Utah woman, 39. Dies 4 days after second dose of COVID-19 vaccine. A healthy, strong, you know, mom with kids. And I mean, that kind of stuff shouldn't be.
No, I think the side effects are being suppressed. I don't have, you know, direct knowledge of this, but I was told from a physician friend that one of the first nurses to get it died of anaphylaxis within, you know, a day. And
I remember seeing on TV or on video, you know, we say TV, whatever we call it, but a lady got the shot, and then for like she couldn't speak after that
yeah.
for 20 minutes. She's like, and like this is out of the gates, and I'm like, okay, this is gonna be real interesting. I mean, this is what we could see.
Yeah, and
if that's what we could see, then
it's just as absurd as them saying, you know, the UK put out. We've had zero flu cases. I tell my students, if there's an absolute, it's wrong. You can never speak in absolutes. The truth is, they're really not testing. They're saying they're testing for flu, but they're not. I have several friends that have been ill, and they weren't positive for COVID, but they didn't test them for the flu. But they had flu symptoms.
Right.
So they want to say, well, yeah, maybe the masks are working because we're not having the flu. No, we're having a flu season, and it's just overlapped and covered up with all what's going on with the COVID.
Well, and I saw a video recently from an MD who's totally on board with the agenda, who's totally in with the CDC and all of this. It was quite fascinating because he said, and I forget the term that he mentioned, but he said that, you know, of course social distance, of course masks, of course all that. But there's this other thing where he said, and you might be familiar with this term, where if somebody gets the COVID virus, something happens within their body that then makes it difficult for them to get the flu virus. And his theory was that is part of the reason
that is
why a lot of the flu numbers are so far down.
I think there's a lot of validity to that. In fact, when I heard the flu numbers were down, that's the first thing I actually told
yeah,
my wife that
yeah.
that there's there our reaction our immune reaction that with the COVID actually, you know, helped build resistance to the flu strain because there are some similarities. And, you know, we have flu every year. We have influenza, and we've had COVID-1, COVID-2, you know, uno, dos, tres, you know, cuatro, you know, whatever country we've had, you know, eins, zwei, drei, vier, fünf, sechs, sieben, acht, neun, zehn, COVID. You know, we've
had, just speak in tongues.
Yes. Now I spoke a little of my German coming out, but you know, we've had it in every country, and we've had, this is COVID-19, we're going to have COVID-20, we're going to have COVID-21. My concern is this the way that we're going to react to it? Is this our society now that, you know, we're going to hide under the sheets every time there's a virus?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. It's very frightening.
The answer is yes.
Yeah. And I'm concerned for my kids. I'm concerned for our society. I'm concerned for my students. It's just no way to live. This is, you know, hiding in fear is no way to live. It's never a way to live. It's paramount to death. You know, taking your identity away. It's death.
It is. Even the World Health Organization back at the beginning of all this, didn't they say that they never actually recommended lockdowns as like a first line of defense against this thing?
Yeah.
They came out and said that's like a last resort.
Yeah,
that's the WHO.
Resort. Yeah.
So there's
that's like Ebola. Like if Ebola was untreatable and gone wild, that's when you know.
Well, I think
put on your suit and hide in your house. But this is not Ebola.
And look, a lot of us, myself included, were like, okay, you know, it's March. Literally, we went on vacation. Myself and another family, or my family and another family, went on vacation to Destin, Florida. Beginning of spring break, the world was as normal. And by the end of the week, the world had shut down. We're trying to get home, you know, buying cases of bottled water on the way. You know, is this the end? Is the rapture?
Plenty of toilet paper, though. Toilet paper was the thing.
Yeah, it was. And one thing that really weirded me out was paper towels. People freaked out about paper towels. I understand the toilet paper freak out.
Yeah.
I didn't understand the paper towel freak. Does nobody have dish rags? I don't know. That was weird to me. But anyway, that's a side thing. But yeah, so the world changed, and so we go home, and we're like, okay, everyone's saying this is like the plague, this is terrible, let's kind of wait it out, let's give it a few weeks and see what is going on. I get that, but I think we knew pretty quick that this wasn't the Black Death. 1 in 4 people weren't going to die. It wasn't killing people indiscriminately, young, old, middle age, and so it was like, okay, in April, I was saying, we need to not quarantine, but maybe encourage the very elderly, the obese. And that's another thing that just came out. 78% of COVID-19 hospitalizations were people that were overweight or obese. That was the CDC.
That's the real problem. The real problem is obesity in our country. You know, and you know, I tell my students, we're in class and we're talking about, you know, disease, and I say, hey, everybody Google a picture of the beaches in 1950. So, you know, my kids get on their phones and like, wow, everybody's got a six pack, don't they? Yeah. What happened? You know, and I tell them the evil clown came with burgers and fries. Yeah.
Ronald McDonald. Hey, but give to this great organization to help kids with cancer, and then of course everything you eat there is going to contribute.
Yeah, I mean obesity is so bad. It creates an autoimmune, you know, response in itself. You're continually in an inflammatory state. Your cardiovascular system is stressed. I mean, it is really a problem, you know, and we're still getting our hands around the fact that, you know, we were looking at the pyramid wrong. It was the food pyramid was all jacked up.
Well, so what I want to end off with, it's kind of a down note, but I think it's important because I think it further illuminates what we're actually dealing with and the forces we're dealing with out there, who you are and what you are to them if you don't comply.
Yeah.
And the Washington Post, which one of the two most popular newspapers in the country.
The only two that are left, right?
it's amazing. And I think the Washington Post is only left because Jeff Bezos makes $1 billion a month. Washington Post calls anti-vaxxers domestic terrorists.
Oh, yeah. It's unbelievable.
Literally, they said this. They said, this was the headline. Anti-vaccine extremism is akin to domestic terrorism.
Yeah, it's because, you know, we're the carriers of all that's bad, and we're going to kill everybody.
If you don't wear a mask, you're essentially a murderer. And like what we were talking about, and where I was wanting to go and get your thoughts on. So I guess I won't totally end off on this, but there was one prominent professional in this realm, I forget his name, that came out and said, we essentially need to mask up because of the low flu numbers that we're seeing, because of course we know it's because of the mask and the social distancing and all this, that every winter, every flu season, we need to wear masks from here on out.
That's absurd, because who dies of influenza? The people that die of influenza are the elderly or the immunosuppressed, and they already wear masks, and they wear the right kind of masks. So, you know, you protect your older population with masks, but, you know, if somebody's sick, you just, you know, you ask them, you go to the house, you say, you know, don't go there, or, you know, if somebody's sick in the house, and you protect that way. But we know who dies of influenza, and everybody wearing a mask is absolutely not the answer for flu season.
Yeah, and
and we have treatment for it. We have Tamiflu. We have treatment for the flu. I mean,
yeah, and you look at how many people die from car accidents.
We should stop driving our own cars.
How many people actually die as a result of bad effects from prescription drugs every year?
Their medication errors are one of the top causes of death in the United States.
So we need to eliminate all prescription drugs.
Eliminate nurses because they're killing people. You know, and I say that as an aside. I don't literally.
Right.
Don't
right.
literally take me
but
at that.
But if you take their logic.
If you take that logic, that's their logic. That's the reasoning. It's absurd logic. It's absurd reasoning. And it just doesn't work.
Well, Rob, this has been a fascinating interview. I'm so grateful that you were able to join us. And like I said, links to the studies and more, there's more stuff we didn't even get to in this interview. We're hitting over an hour now. We'll be in the show notes of this podcast or on the episode page at cgmradio.com/world. You can get it there. How can people follow you online? Do you have a social media presence?
I've gotten rid of my Facebook. Many of my students, they want me to do a podcast, or actually they want me to do a YouTube channel, because I story tell, and you know, I could tell a million stories, and I tell, you know, funny stories about life, about the realities of life. And my students love it, and they want me to do a YouTube channel where it's Colonel Harmon's story time, you know.
Okay, well let's do it, Colonel. Let's definitely do this again. There's many other topics, and we'll probably want to even maybe revisit some of this as more studies and science comes out about it. But when that YouTube channel does happen, we will share that at CGM Radio News. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We are on Parler, on Gab. We're kind of all over the place now. So at CGM Radio News, follow us there, and we will share Colonel Harmon's his YouTube story time with Colonel Harmon page. I can't wait. It was a pleasure having you.
Thank you
for allowing me into your home and bringing my equipment and all this and doing this. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right, guys. Well, that will do it for this week's episode of World News Brief. Make sure to follow us online, like I said, and everything will be in the show notes of this podcast and at cgmradio.com/world. God bless. We'll see you next time.